This is the last of this series, and also at the same time the first of the next series, looking at the ministries of the laity. I think most of you will have met Bill and Judy Deal. Where's Judy got to?
Right here.
Ah, that's right, Bill and Judy Deal, who are going to take on and correct and improve and generally develop some of the themes we've been thinking about this week. And they are very good Lutherans, so that they can correct, of course, my Anglican and English errors. Now, how many people are new? Every time some people come and say, there you are, you see, it's quite a few. So I can go over the sort of ABC very quickly once more. We have been maintaining this week that the only hope of developing a strong laity is to treat them as adults and expect them to be adults. No more sheep. In the words of Ephesians 4, no more children. No more babies. No more people who blame the clergy or anybody else for their own lack of Christian development, because adults look after themselves more. Oh yes, we are responsible very largely under God for our Christian development, and it is awfully easy to blame somebody else. We didn't have a good confirmation class, we haven't got a very good pastor. And that's what children do, but adults look after themselves. You remember that I even dared to say that we could learn something from laity who were not only Lutheran. You will remember that we looked at questions of the clergy and the laity, and again, a real partnership is a partnership between adults, not a patronizing partnership between clergy and laity, or between laity and clergy, because in some churches the clergy are not given their fair status and standing as members of the laos. They're regarded as the funny little religious experts. And you remember also that we've been talking not only about Sunday's ministries, about our ministries in church school and in the liturgy and in stewardship and pledging and that sort of thing, and in burning the mortgage or raising the mortgage, and in visiting in the parish, not only on Sunday's ministries, but we've extended, all over the world church this is happening. We're understanding that the thrust of God's people is also in Monday's ministries and in Saturday's ministries. We are ministers in our occupations on Monday morning. We are ministers in our TV watching or our sports or our entertainment or our travel on Saturdays, even on Saturday night. And today we're going to think particularly about Monday's ministries, because this is where the link with Bill Deal particularly comes. He is one of the senior sales managers for Bethlehem Steel. He is one of the founders of the movement called Laos in Ministry, which the dear old LCA, who are, of course, the best Lutherans, the LCA has now got as a beautiful thorn in their side to remind them about Monday morning. I think we might spend a bit of time talking about industry, and also a little bit of time talking about politics, because those are the two great thrusts in Monday's ministries. And I just want to say straight away that when we think of the ministry of Christians on Monday, we do not merely mean being a decent person. We don't mean that you don't steal somebody else's tools. We don't mean merely that you get coffee for someone who's got a sick headache. No, we do these things. Of course, we have to be decent neighbours wherever we are. We are talking about somehow applying the gospel to the structures of Monday morning. The structures of industry and the structures of politics, the structures of the state and the structures of government and the structures of buying and selling and the structures of a supermarket. Because we can get very sentimental and just say, well, we will be nice people, and then find we have an appalling society we're living in. Which was, of course, the extraordinary mistake made by so many very good Christian Germans who were admirable private citizens and then found they were in the grips of a demonic system. Now, Bill.
I thought you were going to take your part then.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, I'm having you first, please, because let's move in and we can have an argument and that will be much better. Oh, yes. If you give me 5 minutes at the end, I might say something about your American politics, but I daren't say very much. But before I forget, a lot of people have been asking about how they might get details of laity exchange.
and here's a piece of paper, and if you'd like to circulate this and put your name and address on it, some marvellous structural system somewhere will see that you get details. Bill.
You did pull a switch on me, Mark.
Oh, you mean you were going to prepare what you were going to say while you were listening to me?
Yes, right. No, no.
Just carry on.
Okay, I'd like to spend a little time in trying to see how the ministry of the laity can work its way out in industry, for example, and we'll do other kinds of slices of society next week. But with Mark here, we thought we'd talk about the structures of industry. And I guess we have to first back up a little bit and touch on something that Mark said shouldn't be played up too much. But that is an understanding, our basic level of ministry or of serving, and the word to minister is to serve, the basic level of that, I think, is to recognize that we are called to do well in wherever we are, that we've got to concentrate on doing a good job where we are. And I think we recognize that that sometimes is forgotten in terms of a large structure of society. I recognize very well, you might say, well, how does a salesman see that as a sort of ministry? Well, I learned very early in my career with Bethlehem Steel, as a salesperson in Michigan, selling steel for construction industry. We had a small shop there, and every time my car drove into the parking lot, the men in the shop would come out and want to know what kind of a contract I secured for them, and became very clear to me that they were depending upon me to do a good job so that they would have work and their families would be fed and their children clothed and so on. So all through my career as a sales manager, I've been impressing on our people the need to do well, because in a large structure we are so interdependent upon each other that we must do well. So that's the one slice of ministry in a structure. And then the other one is also what Mark alluded to, and that is the relationship we have with other people, the interpersonal relationship, because in a large organization, there is a certain momentum, a certain concentrating on the goals of the organization itself, that you tend to overlook the interpersonal needs that do come up. We have our radios tuned in on certain channels in terms of corporate goals and needs and so on, and sometimes too easily overlook the needs of people in our work group. And so we've got to have our radios tuned in and our antenna tuned in very clearly for how we can relate to the needs of people we work with. At least I found in my type of work that the structures, the goals and so on, are so heavy in the area of performance that people don't want to share in their work environment weaknesses, especially with their superior, with their supervisor, because human weakness perhaps suggests a inability to perform, and since the supervisor is the one who recommends raises and so on, that may weaken their position in terms of advancement in the company or in terms of raises and so on. So there is that need to be very much tuned into the needs of people. But I'd like to move from that to the area that Mark has wanted us to talk about, and that is the ministry in terms of the structures of business and industry today. I find that the challenge always is any given situation is to separate the various kinds of responsibilities that we have, because at the same time we are responsible to a lot of different groups, and in some cases their interests don't coincide. For example, I'm responsible for the people who work in my department. I'm responsible for the people who work out in our plants, our steelmaking plants. Responsible to our customers, responsible to my family, responsible to the people who supply us with products, materials, responsible to society to obey the rules of society, responsible to my managers, my superiors, and responsible to our stockholders. And there are many times when those responsibilities don't coincide. And I think the difficult situation is trying to resolve, you know, whose needs are most need to be served, to be met in a given situation. I guess perhaps the easiest example I can give of this is a very simple one, is a few years back we had a steel plant that had been flooded out. And as soon as the floodwaters came down, the people came back to work to clean up the mess. And it was a lot of work. They worked long hours, overtime, trying to get the plant in operation. Meanwhile, we had customers who were waiting for steel, and their plants were shut down because they didn't have enough steel. So there was tremendous pressure on us to get that plant back in operation. And we were approaching Thanksgiving, and the question came up, should we work our people on Thanksgiving? And they came to me as one person for input and asked, do you recommend that we work our people on Thanksgiving? They've worked so hard, they're tired, they haven't even had time to clean up their own homes. Should we give them the day off? On the other hand, I was looking at our customers whose people were also laid off, and they were pressing, and to take one day out of that cleanup process meant that their people would be out of work one extra day. So there was an example where our plant people in the plant and the people's and our customers' plants had needs that didn't coincide. That one would be hurting because the other one's needs being met. Now this becomes much more complex and complicated than other issues when you talk about foreign steel, when you talk about environmental requirements and so on. You find that the needs of different groups don't coincide, and I find that the ministry in this area is very difficult in finding out, first of all, whose needs do we really address in this situation, and they can change from time to time. And then having said that, then the problem becomes within the structure of the corporation, how do I address those particular needs? Because some of them have a very large social impact that are very difficult to get at. I find, it may be different in other corporations, but I find that within our corporation there's a great attention to the goals of the organization, meeting those objectives, and if you begin dealing with issues outside of those rather restricted areas, then you become a bleeding heart, and they're questioning why are you fussing around with such issues. And the only way you can really get away with raising those issues is to be sure that you have a good performance. That sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but good achievers, high achievers, are able to afford the luxury of raising issues regarding human needs and human concerns. And unfortunately, people who are not high achievers are very much discarded, not listened to when they raise issues of human needs and human concerns. And that's unfortunate, but I find it is true. One other thing before I turn it back to you, Mark, is the whole, I'm struggling very much, we hear a lot about the idea of corporate conscience. If corporations had a better conscience, society would be better. I struggle with that because corporate decision-making involves so many different groups having input to a decision. It's never the same group depending upon what the issue is. If it's environmental, then you have operating people and public relations people and lawyers inputting. If it's something else, product quality, you have something else. And so the different input of different people with different values and different objectives and different needs presents a pattern where there is no clear thread that I can see of what you could say is a corporate conscience. And I've come to the point where I believe that on the issues of the major issues of society, we need to insist that our government set certain rules for corporate behavior. And we were talking, I was talking to Pat Keister at Coffee Break. The example that I give so clearly is environmental concerns. The steel industry is a dirty industry. It pollutes the air, it pollutes water. And you might say, well, why didn't the steel industry many years ago, why wasn't there some enlightened company that began putting money into pollution control equipment? The reason is it has been a very competitive industry, and I think it, frankly, I think it is somewhat naive to picture a steel company putting major expenditures of money, and it is very expensive, into pollution control equipment while the other companies are not doing it and thereby gaining a commercial advantage by using that money in some other direction, perhaps to improve their equipment or to put out in the field more salespeople or whatever, thereby gaining an advantage. And it wasn't until the government said everybody's going to do it that put us all back on an even level, and then things began to happen. And we're putting major amounts of money into pollution control equipment. I found that I did a lot of hard work in the 1960s trying to get blacks in our sales organization. And it took a lot of work to get the first black person in our organization. And then came 1964 and the Civil Rights Act, and the government said to companies like ours and other companies, look, you are going to hire minority people or else you're not going to get any government contracts. And oh boy, then did we start looking for black people, you know. So I think in terms of the larger issues, the larger social issues, I very much say, feel that it is somewhat naive to expect a benevolent corporate conscience to emerge in our country. I think we get at that as citizens within the organization and outside, working through the governmental process, saying this is the kind of corporate behavior we expect, and we expect it of all people in corporate areas. So let me just stop there, and you can pick up. I'm sure you want to have questions.
Well, no, that's exactly the way into the other side of looking at structures. That is looking at government and political structures, because we've had for many years in Europe exactly the same point. If you treated, for instance, your child employees well, and if you had lots of safety equipment, and if you had anti-pollution regulations in your plant, and others didn't do this, they were going to make better profits. So you do have to have a state, a governmental rule that everybody has to keep, or else. On the other hand, of course, this positive idea that government can help is now unpopular. You know, it's been very interesting to me as an Englishman watching your self-examination, your uneasiness about Independence Day, your feelings. You know that it is a country to be proud of, and yet it isn't. Your feeling that, in fact, if I may say so, I mean, I am only a visitor here, and I've got to be careful what I say about the United States, but I've been coming here now for 20 years, and I've been teaching American politics for 10 years, 15 years before that. I think you do have to remember it's not necessarily greener the other side of the frontier. If you look at the state of human government in this world at the moment, you could do much better, but you could do very, very much worse, and I hope you don't. It's fair to be disillusioned about government and about bureaucracy and about, New Jersey government or Washington government or anything like that. But nevertheless, we are called to live in something like a democracy. And many Christians still have the political theory of a slave state or of a village. Let me explain what I mean. Very many Christians are basically people who will be good to their neighbours and feel that up there is an evil government, Caesar or the Nazis or something like that, and you can't do anything about that. You can just be nice as fellow slaves. Now that is not what people whom God puts in a democracy are called to. I think we ought to remember there are very many absolutely dreadful governments in this world. I think we never can see how lucky we are. But you don't have to look back into Nazi times or the times of Stalin. You only got to look carefully at the papers. I sent to press today an article about the persecutions of journalists and of social reformers in Argentina. The absolutely disgusting things which are going on in a great many countries. And that is the sort of thing which grows if Christians and if people of goodwill give up and assume all they can do is run a decent family in an indecent society. Then also, it is very, very tempting just to go in for village politics, or if you like, village and township and suburban politics. We all have this. I mean, it's a very human tendency. And it isn't any good people going on and on and on about how we ought to be helpful about Indonesia. Basically, we worry about our local environment. This is very human, and we better accept this. We worry about our village, we worry about our suburb, we worry about our district of the town, we maybe worry about our city. But, you know, it's difficult to get Christians to worry about their city as a whole. It's very difficult to worry about a state or a country or about the whole of humankind. It really is. So we've got to accept this, but also realize that it is a terrible trap to have a nice Westchester County, or to have a nice Mercer Island, or to have a nice Malibu. It is a terrible trap to worry only about our local community and pay no attention to the bigger metropolis or the bigger conurbation or the cancerous poverty and evil which goes on in other areas. We are called to struggle in the big structures, not just in the little ones. We must admit this is very difficult. It involves us in all kinds of complicated political and economic questions. And that's why I so much admire people like Senator Mark Hatfield, who comes from a pietist tradition. I hope you do. I don't know if you've read his book, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, because he's so human. Time and time again, he wants to go back to Oregon. Time and time again, he says, I don't want to struggle in the political atmosphere of Washington, in the bargains that have to be made, in the compromises that have to be made. Nothing gets through Congress except by compromise. And thank God he's somebody who knows how to make responsible compromises. Because we not only have a political system in your country and in mine, but we have a party political system. And it is impossible to have any authority in either major party without to some extent joining in those compromises and bargains by which the world is run. Now, I do see a great danger in your great democracy, that this year, which is election year, you may be so disillusioned with the candidates of either side and so fed up with the muddle and the mess that you may opt out and not bother to vote and, you know, just let things go. And this could, I don't want to be too party political, but you know the great saying of the Irishman Edmund Burke, for evil to triumph, it is only necessary for good men to do nothing. And in fact, if too few people vote, you may get some very terrible results in the next 5 to 10 years. This country could be pretty totalitarian. Not, I think, from the left, more likely from the right. Just as in other countries in Europe, if the good average voters don't bother to vote, and if enough good people don't stand for political office, which I know is a horrible strain in time, a horrible strain in money, a great worry about getting into debt, you know. But if we don't have people in these structures, then it will be rather like a good many countries in Europe, where a rather evil minority manages to get somewhere because of an apathetic majority. Then again, although it is true, a lot of government seems to be pretty messy and mediocre and sometimes downright oppressive when the computers go wrong or something like that, there is a possibility of doing much good through government. And I don't think we want to give up on that. Just as you said, a great deal of industry operates far better and is more at ease with good ground rules established by the democratic process, which are fair to everybody. So in a lot of the work of looking at the poor, a lot of the work of looking at the poor internationally, we may think it is very noble to take up a collection. It is right to do ambulance work and to have a voluntary societies, even Lutheran societies, through the leaf of this and the help of that and the stopping of the other. A great deal of the world is now pushed either for good or for bad by governmental mechanisms. I'll give you an example. I was in Africa and I met there a young American who comes from your AID, your International Development Agency in Washington. And that has a very bad reputation in some ways. The money is wasted, the aid doesn't get anywhere, and it's all mixed up with all kinds of political considerations. So those that, you know, for the United States get the money and the others don't, and it tries to stop communism and all that sort of thing. And it is clear that government aid of any kind, French government aid, even British government aid, It does have to be looked at because it is, to some extent, a weapon in international diplomacy. But he also talked about his work and the work of his colleagues, and he was in Vietnam aid, and he was been in some else East Asia. He was inspecting, in fact, some African aid on the part of Washington to see whether it was being wasted or not. And although these structures are the United Nations structures, they're wearisome and they're inefficient and sometimes they're very wasteful, it is clear that the projects he was involved in, even if only 10% of them come off, are probably doing more good than almost any voluntary society could ever do. Because, you see, power is with governments. That's very unfortunate, maybe. It's very messy. It's very tricky for Christians to be involved in power. But power is with governments. And we must do our bit to seeing that power is used wisely. So we are into grey areas and difficult areas. And some Christians would rather go and live in communes in the Washington woods or the Welsh woods, you know. And some people despair and say, well, all we can do is a little community action in our bit of the ghetto in the inner city or something. But your country, like mine, has a very fine tradition that a good many Christian laity take the risks and find the courage to go into the structures of government and of industry. They somehow have the grace from God to exercise power responsibly. And that is a very noble tradition, and your church, like mine, ought to encourage this and say, you are not being a defective Christian because you take the risks of going into these structures. You are being a frontline Christian. And we will sometimes criticize you, but we will also affirm you and support you, because what you're doing on Monday morning is a ministry. Well, maybe we could have a few little points raised and a little discussion on that. We've got quite a lot of time, and don't forget that Bill is here to take the really awkward questions. at the back, I think, and then yourself. At the back first.
Would you explain what you meant by we are called to live in a democracy?
Yeah.
Yes, God puts us in a country. I mean, we can change it. We have some freedom to emigrate, change, and a good many people do that these days, one way or another. But we are called to live in some kind of human society. If you were called to live in Cambodia now, you couldn't really say you were, you know, that's a terrible thing. And a good many people are called to live in Soviet Russia. They're called to live in Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil. You can make a long list of places where it is certainly not much of a democracy, and therefore your political responsibilities there can be terribly grim.
Political structure.
There is no political structure that is God-given. In this world, we shall live in defective structures, but some are more defective than others. We are very lucky indeed that we are called to live even in the imperfect democracies of the United States and of Britain or of Western Germany or Sweden or somewhere like that. Of course they're not perfect states. There's a great deal wrong. But they are self-critical and self-reforming, because at least we have the freedom. As somebody said after that forum 2 nights ago, at least we live in a country where we can have a discussion like this. And I have friends, I have known friends, and I have been in societies where you just cannot raise that kind of question. To raise the question itself is an offence, and you vanish. And what the beastly things that they do to you, you're very lucky if anybody even knows about it. So that's what I mean by saying that we are called, if you like, we are very fortunate that with all its mistakes, we are able to live in the United States or in Britain. And if you know people who live in other countries, there's a great deal wrong. And in a way, the dream of the perfect American republic's gone. And that's a good thing, because then we can be more realistic about what the United States can and cannot do, just as the dream of the British Empire's gone. But there are a damn sight better countries to live in than most of many others that I know. I think it's a good idea to look at some of the best. I mean, I really feel, for instance, you might look sometimes at Canada, New Zealand, Denmark, the Netherlands, some of those countries, because without making quick comparisons, I think it's a good idea to learn from other countries where you can. And in some ways, it seems to me, they solve better than America or Britain the problems of running an efficient, profitable industry with a humane society. And some of them are big countries, some of them are small. But to learn from like that is a good way forward. You had a point, I think.
When I asked Bill, I was surprised to hear someone in industry sort of building an argument for more government regulation, almost, so to speak, or at least government rules for business. I guess, not being an expert at all in that field, mm-hmm. but it would seem that if the government were doing things like that that were costly and then asking everybody to start doing them so that they would get rid of that competition, that where that breaks down today is our open market in the world with foreign competition. And is I've heard, certainly, I live in Michigan now, and, you know, we hear that all the time, especially now, you know, with the pressures about the imported automobiles. And that's exactly the argument that people are using, that say, oh, we've got to, you know, limit foreign competition at this because they're not living by the same rules.
You've raised a lot of things there.
Yeah.
First of all, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that government is a solver of all our problems. Mm-hmm. I happen to be involved in the human service area as a volunteer, and I've been very discouraged with the fact that our government has not been delivering the quality of human services that I think we really should be delivering. We got to work on that. So I don't think government is the solver of all our problems, but I think in certain areas, we should call upon government to set the rules for industry, to be the umpire, the referee, to make sure that those rules are observed. And I think that will help a lot in terms of achieving some of our social goals, not all of them, of course. But you raised the issue of open, use the word open trade, I don't recall exact words you used, and that does become another issue to be dealt with. Living in Michigan, you're very much aware of what's happening right now. For the first time, U.S. government is now saying, well, maybe we better relax those pollution control requirements for automobiles because we've got to help the U.S. auto industry be more competitive in its home market. And it's very difficult to address this because we aren't talking about apples and apples in terms of how other governments look at their international trade. In some societies, the government and industry are in much less of an adversary relationship than they are in America, where government and industry do planning for the forthcoming year in order to maintain the proper level balance of payments and achieve certain national goals. And so as a result, in certain industries, the automobile producers, in some cases steel producers, do have certain governmental subsidies, direct or indirect, which we don't have in the United States. Then the issue becomes, well, therefore, are we really having free and open trade, or should there be some kind of balancing done so that there is an opportunity for those countries in the world that don't have the same kind of subsidies to or protections or whatever to be able to compete equally in world markets. I find it very difficult, as Chris, but I believe very much that we should have free and open trade between nations. I think that's very good. I think it's important for world peace. Yet at the same time, if it isn't a fair kind of competition, I see people in our steel plants being laid off. July is going to be an awful month. July could very well be, we're predicting it's going to be the worst month for steel production since 1933. Forgetting any years we were on strike. It's going to be an awful month. And a large part of it is foreign steel. So, you know, I have this responsibility of people in our own plants. Mm-hmm. And yet the larger responsibility is for free and open trade in the world. And it's difficult.
And don't people say that the reason the auto industry and the steel industry haven't been able to, quote-unquote, keep up or remain as competitive as they once were with foreign markets was because of the government regulation? At least we hear that a lot.
It's
It's a number of things.
I don't believe it. No, I don't believe that necessarily true, but I certainly
combination of government control, yes, a combination of poor past management, of not enough foresight. We were fat, dumb, and happy in the 1950s, and we weren't providing for the future. We were not replacing equipment, and modernizing, and so on. And
then isn't there the issue of labor involved?
Well, it's a number of, quite a few factors.
Actually, it is very interesting. There is beginning some world legislation on these points ever since the 1920s. We always blame the United Nations for everything, but in fact, some of its technical work, some of the work of the International Labour Office, some of the work of the European Community in looking at labour conditions all around Europe, you see, and some of the agreements between the European Community and the United States and Japan are beginning to pull together sort of minimum wage ideas for industries worldwide and some kind of controls and, for instance, some attempts at having uniform regulations on marketing with South Africa and so on. It's only just beginning, but it is beginning. And many British firms now have to watch very closely what the European regulations are and not just the British ones. Yes, please.
I was wondering, like in many of these corporate structures or in dealing with, you say, a supermarket or in whatever structure you're in, many of your decisions or the way you look at a problem comes from your being a Christian. Now, does it look to the other person like you are a Christian or a kind person, or is the Christianity aspect of your, I mean, if that comes into play in a decision of yours, is that often acknowledged, or, I mean, I guess look at it. Sometimes our Christian philosophies do come into play, but do we acknowledge them, or do we need to?
You mean, do I render an opinion and say I'm saying this because I am a Christian? Is that what you're asking?
Well, it's not quite that direct,
no.
But I mean, but it's somewhat that, yeah.
That's not my style.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of God's gift to me, I am therefore called to work for a just society, and mm-hmm. to find out what mechanisms provide for justice in our society is the way I look at my problem solving. But I don't put up my hand and say, "Here's my solution," because
mm-hmm.
I am a Christian. And you can argue with that. I find that in our company, those people who do come strong on their Christianity tend to have people stay away from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think where our Christian faith comes in is in our standing before God and our understanding of grace, because we know who we are and whose we are, and that we are sent, then it does give us a calling under God, which enables us to be take more risks. It enables us to get involved in messy situations without worrying and without being over guilty and without necessarily feeling too much upset because we fail. It does seem to me that Christian courage is a virtue very much to be emphasized, not Christian timidity.
Mm-hmm.
And if we live by grace, we don't have to worry so much about the state of our souls. Yes, there's one here. Yeah.
Try to apply what you said to see what members in my church would be, how they'd be responding. And one that comes to mind is a factory that closed down recently. The owner is a member of my church, and he says it was closed for mainly two reasons. One was the tremendous absenteeism Mondays and Fridays, utter unreliability, just made it impossible to operate. And the second reason was what he claims to be harassment of officials regarding safety inspections and all of that, the OSHA thing. And of those, he would be the first to say that the major reason was the first one. And I wonder sometimes if we play down as too insignificant the aspect of decency. We're trying to make the point not to overlook the other. But if I heard you saying this, we really need to stress more people doing their job well, having a conscience about their job. When I see how hard people work where we were 16 years in Hong Kong, or see Germany where my wife is from, we've got to change our concept of hard labor, you know, take our job much more seriously. And I think that the church has a big role there too, to stress the old comment. We can't assume that people, of course, are going to be decent. They ain't.
What would you say on that?
Yeah, of course, in certain kinds of occupations, it's much easier than others.
Yes.
You know, I'm the kind of a job where I can say, yeah, by doing well, people work. And we mentioned earlier about this business of selling, another forum. I'm thankful I'm selling steel rather than insurance policies. Because if any of you bought a ton of steel you didn't need, I asked that question once and somebody says, yes, I bought a 1948. But I do see in the steel industry, for example, some classifications of jobs that I think are very difficult to see how doing well means much. Our drop forge area, where the men are in there, it's hot, it's heavy, they're holding pretty heavy pieces of steel, and the forges are coming down, they wear ear protectors, so for 8 hours, except for lunch break, you cannot communicate with anybody. It's hot, it's heavy work, and the part they're making is a semi-finished product. It goes to some other plant to be processed. They never see the finished product. You know, now how do they say, by doing well, I'm living to the glory of God. It is difficult in some areas. What were you going to say? Are you correct?
No, I was going to amplify that point. That, I mean, obviously there is, in many people's personal lives, there are options for being decent to your fellow workers and being responsible to your boss or not being responsible. I mean, most people have a great capacity for passive resistance and being awkward if they feel like it. On the other hand, more and more work now, it is so regulated by machinery or by computers or by a time study or something that, you know, you just have to, you have to do it, and there is no freedom to do it well or do it badly. Now, we must remember that New Jersey port plant where they had all that trouble, because although it was highly organized, you know, there was obviously a lot of trouble until they got near disaster. In fact, whether they improved or not, the plant is now closed. So I don't deny your point at all. What worries me is that some churches and some evangelical sects, if I say so especially, concentrate only on personal behaviour and a certain dutifulness to the employer and don't look at the structural question at all. Please.
Well, could I respond to the example of people in the drop board plant? I do this with some embarrassment. But I wonder if that isn't an example that news of the Lord of the God of the natural creation makes evident a sort of certain miracle of the way that he put the matrix of the universe together, that if the people are attuned to, that they can take an ongoing amount of pride, that they can produce something in a drop forge which other people cannot, that you somehow miraculously change, much the way you need the breath, you change something by dint of your skill and effort and the discomfort in which you apply it to it, which ought to be able to provide the kind of pride blacksmith has had for 1,000 years, even though it's done in a big area and
massive. Well, I see quite a difference between the blacksmith and the guy in the drop forge. The blacksmith is really a craftsman and producing a finished product. And the fellow in the drop forge is not. It's not a finished product, and it is not his own personal craftsmanship. He holds a piece of steel this way, the hammer goes up, he turns it over, the hammer comes down. It's designed for him how he will do it. and he's not put his own craftsmanship to it. So I struggle with certain kinds of jobs, and you could say, well, then we should design out of our industry those kind of jobs, and I guess we should, but that, of course, requires capital, and we're back to the profit problem, you know, of generating enough profit to modernize equipment and design out the kind of jobs that are dehumanizing.
Yes, please. The one and then two at the back there. Yes, that's right.
Well, I was thinking, though, it used to be the thing. Car thing was planned obsolescence. Was it 4 years or so? And all you get planned obsolescence really getting to a church. Really, you become a member of a church, and then there you are. That's all you have to do. So you don't get any faster. Somewhere, I think maybe the auto boys might think about having a. And you buy a car, and you pay a little bit extra for time, that after a certain number of miles, that baby gets shipped back to the plant, runs through the production line again, and comes back to you, ready to go.
Recycle.
Yeah, recycle. And the same as we have to recycle when we show up the hole in there. I kind of get a recycling feeling.
Oh, a couple things that for the future that I wonder about. One is in the corporate structure, because I know my corporate structure experience is way down, whereas yours is way up. I'm wondering when the corporate structure is approaching the profit system, the situation. Just for curiosity, I've often wondered, is there responsibility to the stockholder to keep increasing the stock profit each year? How does that balance with your responsibility to your workers? That would be one question. And then the second question, I guess, which concerns me, and we had a talk about this yesterday after the Cesar Chavez, who I've always, you know, he's been there, and I've thought about pro and con, and being from the state of Washington, unions have been very, very important here. In fact, I made the comment that Washington has always been called the 48, this was before we had more states, the 47 states in the Soviet of Washington. So our history here of unionization has been very strong, and I was raised with this. But I see this as a problem for the future with union, and wondering how do we balance that whole system. So essentially I'm giving you two questions.
What was the second one?
The union influence, and have unions gone too far? Has our whole cycle gone so far? And where do we get people and division of labor back into this?
Well, again, the union relationship has changed, especially in the industries that are threatened. The automotive steel, unions are now in the forefront, actually, of protectionism in the steel industry. And I think they are non-supportive also. So that situation has changed. But my profit thing, I guess there again, I'm personally somewhat thankful. I don't know the answer to your question of how much profit is enough. I'm thankful, in a way, I'm in an industry. We're, in terms of the industrial groupings, we're 33rd out of 34th in terms of profit. We're in a survival mode. The steel industry in the United States is in a survival condition. It may not survive. We may not have a steel industry in the United States 30 years from now. So the thinking is in terms of just trying to get enough profit to get some new equipment to do this and do that. And we haven't had to face the issue of how much profit is too much.
How much is enough? You know, this is the question. What we were talking about this morning in Bible study. How much is enough?
Well, for me, enough is in order to keep the organization going, to keep people employed, and to be able to continue to be competitive in terms of technology and products and so on. And that, to me, would seem to be enough. And on that scale, we're not doing too well.
No, there is when you say you have to have enough to keep going,
yeah.
You've always got to have enough to modernize, which is very difficult in inflation time. You also have to pay your stockholders something if you ever hope to raise any capital. And this is a very tricky, all kinds of governments wrestle with this. You obviously want to tax enormous profits. And therefore governments also, and the taxing system is very much involved in what is a reasonable return. Now, obviously, you have to give some return, otherwise people just put it in government stock or something like that, or they won't invest it with you. But it is very tricky working out the morality of dividends. Yeah?
But there's another stage of morality, though, that gets raised. We've sort of been skirting around when you raise the issue, well, whoever bought a ton of steel that they don't need. Well, none of us in this room probably bought a ton of steel, but how many products do we buy, including the cars, that we don't need, you know what I mean? And that, or that all the ammunitions that the steel industry supplies. And then it really gets into that cycle, too. You know, can you, if you're in that industry, divorce yourself from what happens before in terms of responsible use of resources to get the materials to make it in the first place, and then what who you sell it to for what they're going to do with it. And
you know,
to me, if I were in your position,
really an island.
That would really be hard for me if I were in your position to.
Well, let me put it right around. If you were in my position and felt that that there was too much, let's take the appliance industry, consumer of steel, selling new appliances, new ovens, refrigerators, and so on all the time. If you felt they were promoting to the extent that people are buying things they really don't need, how would you attack that problem?
I don't know how I would. I mean, as I say, but I don't know that divorcing or not looking and not being aware of that aspect of it, I think that is important.
See, the only way I attack it, and it probably is a very insignificant and meaningless way, was somewhat along the line of our earlier hour of our own lifestyle, of saying, you know, we don't need all that stuff in our family, at least. I get very impatient with the fashion industry. Wide lapels, narrow lapels, wide ties, narrow ties, all this sort of thing. Perfectly adequate clothing that we have. And I get really upset about that. I'm not going to go along with that kind of foolishness. And then somebody from the textile industry comes up to say, do you realize you're putting us out of work if you advocate that kind of a philosophy?
That's the whole thing, you know. If you move one checker, you know, every other checker on the board is
out of the list. Statistics. Yes, but we do not necessarily have to have the present range of consumer goods and the present range of armament goods in order to keep a healthy steel industry going. There are so many genuinely unmet needs.
Yes, right. Rebuilding
rebuilding
our cities.
Sure, I know there are. Yeah.
Rebuilding
true.
Our
yeah.
cities
yeah.
in itself.
Yeah.
If we can rebuild our cities, that in itself would be a great source of...
Mass transit system.
Mass transit.
Maybe.
Yeah.
He's mentioning things that will give you more orders. But he's quite right. It's a matter, I mean, after all, it's a matter of your priorities in national spending, let alone international spending. And it is
an outbridge.
What? Yes. Was there something? Yes, please. There.
We mentioned that the steel industry is not getting enough profits, so that they have to figure they may not survive. But I have a hard time as a Christian and as a good citizen facing up to is. How should I respond to the petroleum industry to the just vast profits that they had in the time when our imports have been restricted? And this just seems to be the essence of poor conscience on their part.
Well, to some extent, of course, those profits were a windfall in that as the world price of oil goes up, and as they have stocks which they've bought at earlier prices or contracted for at earlier prices, you know, there are special reasons, and this is also true of European oil companies. What surprises me is the messy situation with regard to your government regulation, and also the messy situation in which some of those profits are not necessarily going to be invested in alternative energy supplies.
They already aren't.
They're not. I mean, there are a great many ads about this, how marvelously they're doing this, that, and the other. But this is not. It seems to me very effectively being done. Now, I wouldn't like to end on a chauvinistic, nationalistic note, but there are European countries, Britain among them, who do perhaps have slightly better regulation of this kind of thing. It is just about 20 minutes of 12, and you must have a brief break before we have the lunch. Are there anything else someone wants to raise? or would you like to leave these questions for Bill Deal, you know, starting next on Monday? There's one at the back.
I get awfully interested in the human side of these stories. Was the Thanksgiving vacation given? And do either of you have a particular story where you were found between a rock and a hard spot?
Well, to answer your question, yeah, we gave the Thanksgiving vacation. But that's a good point in terms of a corporate conscience. I was asked to render my opinion as a manager of sales for the products of that plant. The plant manager who operated the plant also was asked for his opinion with regard to the people working in the plant. A number of different people had input into that before the decision was made. Now, somebody in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania might look at that decision and say, ah, there's a company with conscience. And the next week they might say, where's the conscience of that company? Because, you know, the different kinds of people inputting the decision making, so it isn't a level kind of thing.
Well, did they work or didn't they?
They had off for Thanksgiving.
And we're at our short break now. But let me say, since I'm leaving now, and because Bill is going to take all these heavy responsibilities with Julie for next week, it has been a great pleasure being here. I've been very fascinated by the way in which, in the middle of a vacation and a holiday and the kids and all the rest of it, a lot of Christian learning goes on in this place. And I think it's very fine, and thank you very much for having me.